Don Finkel is one of the most loved and respected poets in this region. He's been a friend and mentor to many of the poets in the community. He's one of the most accomplished poets in the nation, the author of 14 books. Each, like any great artist, he goes off in different directions in any given collection, and the book is a form unto itself when Don approaches it. Among his titles, I could name them all because they're all wonderful, but among my favorites, since I made up this press release, are Adequate Earth, the dual poem Endurance and Going Under, Selected Shorter Poems, Splintered Mirror, his translations from the Chinese, and his most recent book, A Question of Seeing, which came out just 1998, and reaffirms that he's very much at the top of his profession and of his own chops are still very much up there. He's been retired from Washington U and teaching a little here and little there in the intervening couple of years. He's now a visiting professor at Webster University and very much a force on the poetry scene. So we're thrilled, as always, to present him here. He's been part of the Duff series since the very beginning, and this will be another step in making it new. So please welcome Donald Finkel.
Okay, thank you very much. Enough. I thought that the first poem I'd read was back when I was a child, about 40 years ago. That's actually half a child. I'm still a child. It's a poem that I thought was appropriate since it's about music. It's a poem called Letter to an Alto Man, a guy I met actually in Illinois, the University of Illinois. He was my roomie there. His name was Joe. And he told me this, and I could hardly believe him, but it made sense. The first line of the poem is what he said. Any note I want to, any time. That's what you said. I think of it often. Knees bent, hunched over your horn, running your fingers up and down as if over a row of hard, golden nipples. Nothing you do is wrong. It cries with pleasure. Between sets, we lit up in the alley and walked about in the night where nobody fluffs. You were married last time I heard, had a daughter, and drove to 1,000 horns a bus in South Chicago. I have a daughter. The same night fingers the bumps of Chicago, though you and I stay home. We do what we will, or might as well. Nothing we do is wrong. Solid, the notes rise in the smoky air, one after the other, of their own accord. I thought it would be at least appropriate to read a poem about poetry. As if I tell my students not to do that, because all their poems are about poetry. I understand that, but I shouldn't do that in front of them. Some of them are even here to hear. The poem I'm thinking of, if I can find it, is called "The Dismal Science." Does anyone know what the dismal science is? Economics. Isn't that a wonderful term? It makes perfect sense, but then there's poetry. That's another dismal science. The one I've begun working with a long time ago, and it's as dismal as ever. God damn, where is it? I don't think I've memorized it. Yeah, can you do it offhand? No, I know where it is. It's in here. I just remembered. So luckily I brought it with me. 48. There it is. How did you find it? No, I didn't hit it at all. I mean, it's in the wrong book. That's why. I knew there was something wrong. Here it is. Wrong page, right book. Yeah, I got it. Like the hogs in Iowa sometimes. Too much of it now. And no one's buying. Oh, it smelt so of promise. The great trucks reeked of it. Sows bursting with farrow, the city clamoring, the prices soaring. In the guts of the city, a young man hunches over a kitchen table, scribbling, his freezers crammed with bittersweet elegies, low-salt epigrams. Poems breed in his larder. He goes on scribbling. He could pick up an epic this morning from the takeaway rack at the local supermarket. All over the city, young men are scribbling, and old women, and school children, and several chimpanzees. The young man persists in his kitchen, parboiling a dithyramb, while the sows go on farrowing in Iowa. Welcome to the 11th plague, plenty. There's room enough in here for everyone. There really is. I teach poetry still, so I'm getting all these people coming in, and I'm not telling them that it's really, there's too much of it already. What can you do? You can't talk them out of it anyway, so I might as well make some money that way. Here's a poem that is about halfway back, too. I had a friend. It's hard to believe that what I've got in mind here is actually the case. There's only a couple of differences. I say he was standing in front of the, excuse me, he was standing in front of one museum, actually, who was standing in front of another. It really doesn't make much difference which museum you go to. His name was Hofstein, but I call him Saint Hofstein. This is a poem and a prayer to Saint Hofstein. Saint H. was born at the age of 33 to an elderly candy store in the West Bronx. He set up shop at once in a room in the back. One iron cot, a box of books, and Madame Blavatsky. The iron-faced virgin glared at his every breath from the lintel with a thumbtack in her forehead. St. H. endured terrible migraine headaches. So passed his childhood. At the age of 33, looking 12 years older, blinking behind his glasses, his brown, good-natured eyes of an intelligent cocker spaniel, St. H. stepped out of his shell into the sunlight. An angular second-hand bookstore from Queens played stoop ball with a runny-nosed kid brother. The scene was etched in sunlight. The dust glittered. St. H. performed several middle-aged miracles. He buried a half dollar at the foot of a ginkgo in front of his mother's. Next day, dug up a dime. He ate no meat, saying, "A man is what he eats. I am a vegetable." He drank water as if it were wine. He made old women smile. For weeks on end, he lived on absolutely nothing but an occasional slice of love on a dry bagel, simply because he forgot. He wrote a book on the squaring of the circle, proposing therein a new geometry. Theorem one, the line is beautiful. He lectured on dreams at the Lonely Hearts Club social. All day Sunday, he stood in front of the Museum of Natural History, waiting for Martians. "They walk among us," he said when we were assembled. "They wear our clothes and our faces and speak our language." Somebody asked the obvious. He smiled. "They will recognize me." St. H., patron of all those who are born middle-aged with a PhD in astrology, of all those the Martians have forgotten, St. H. of the Lonely Heart, St. H. of the Square, St. H. of Queens, shrine in back of the bookstore. She has gone blousy. The children all have colds. Constant haggle over the vegetables. Gentle spaniel, I lift your homely image with outstretched hands. I drive from this room the demons of pride and impatience. St. H., may I be 33 forever, like you. This is called Flying Song, and it's a shorty. Smoke on the wind, I travel light, my way is flight, my cries are music. A bowl of earth, a burning coal, and at my feet the blessed weeds, the earth's sweet trash are all I need. Seed on the wind, I go alone, I light where I can, I stir the flowers with my coal and drink the smoke, the trash of trash, I'm nowhere long. A bowl for my hearth, the fire my friend, I fly when I can, and damn the cost, I think what I am, I know what I'll be, sweet trash. Sweet trash in the roadside dust. I don't know how many of you have a bowl for your hearth. I do. It's a real small pipe, but it works. That's where I got my poems. I'm not absolutely sure why, because I'm a cat person, actually. In fact, I think I'm a cat. I keep writing about dogs all the time. Anybody who's spent any time on a campus knows that they're usually infested with dogs. This one's called Campus Dogs. The dachshund yaps from his backyard till you're past, a volley of threats more terrible than Pan's, before whom hardened veterans pissed in their greaves. Whereas these trespassers in no dog's land have come to sniff the runes on the ivy leaves. The shepherd bitch with the frisbee in her teeth, how thoughtfully she rests it by that puddle, how tranquilly she drapes one paw across her consummate booty and bends to drink from the pool of enlightenment, while her witless cousins grumble behind their hedges, deconstructing the morning, barking at anything that comes their way. It is hard to figure out what they're doing when they're barking. I came across a wonderful quote. Let's see if I can find it. It's a delightful quote. Yes, from the Smithsonian. And the quote goes like this. They turn me on, these wonderful quotes. Natural selection would seem to have endowed dogs with an extraordinary, subtle and powerful system of context interpretation for them to derive so many distinct meanings from a single signal. You wonder what they're saying, don't you? I mean, especially at night in Mexico, it was insane. It went on all night long. And they were communicating, but it sounded like the same word over and over and over again, not to them. This is called the Dictionary of Barking. A greeting, a warning. I'm hungry. I'm here. Let me out. Let me in. No. Yes. Help. Cat. The others are barking. It's too damn quiet. The Dictionary of Barking has but a single word and a trillion definitions. The dictator knows this well. So does the janitor. The poet's dictionary has a trillion words, but not a single definition. The poet barks like a dog for the sheer hell of it, but softly, softly, and hardly anybody hears. Thanks. But after writing a lot of, those are not the only ones, but after writing a lot of nasty poems about dogs, I was beginning to feel guilty, and I had a wonderful dog, Binker, and this poem actually was to Binker, long gone but never forgotten. It's called For Every Dog, and it doesn't exist in this book where I'd written down, so I'll find it quickly. I assume I'll find it. Here it is, 131. For every dog, there comes a day. This is it. Henceforth, there will be no more collars, no more leashes, licenses, no more trappings, jangling tags, trappings of fealty. My name is Rex, King of Jackals. I belong to Sapiens, 123 Grovel Street. Henceforth, call me Snarl. I belong to my teeth. I live where I sit. You will set me a place at your table. Cut me a key of my own. Henceforth, I will go when I please, in or out. You will chain the cat out front to the bird bath, throw him a bone, and when you call again, here, boy, look out for your throat. I can't imagine Binker doing it, but I said it for him. All right, let's try something depressing. I mean, I can't stand all this funny. A dear friend of mine went through, actually, she and her husband both went through the hell. He wasn't awake most of the time. He was in the hospital, mostly out of it, and his heart was really going out pretty fast. But he was going to get another one. However, the other one just hadn't shown up. So he just lay there in a coma, hour on hour, day on day, waiting for that heart. And it just seemed like such a strange experience, even though most of the time I guess he was stoned, in his own way, or the hospital's own way. It depends on how you look at that. To the living, the words for death are like the dead. When they come calling, they're difficult to make out, ragged at the edges, unaccountably ghosts, voices hoarse and thin with long disuse. To the dying, the words for life evoke the same uncanny shudder. Once the word endure had fire in her eyes, strode so firmly across the boards of mourning, they groaned at her passage. Now, at night, she whimpers in the corridor. Someone calls timidly, but she won't come in. Someone floats on his back as the current bears him. Some seasons bobbing on Arctic calms, timeless, numb. Some seasons basking on incandescent sands. Would send a postcard, but he's out of stamps. And what should he write? The weather's here, wish I were fine? A new language is needed, compounded almost entirely of verbs and prepositions, vast and languorous as whales. A language untroubled by nouns, without person or tense, one gender and infinite moods. From time to time, the room reappears, the same room, yet always a different face dangling just out of reach, like some gross, amorphous fruit better left untasted. Having finished shaving someone's grizzled beard, the nurse holds up a mirror. Doesn't that look younger? Immersed in his own dissolution, he's too busy to look. See what his children see. Between him and them, an unbridgeable chasm widens with every wheeze of the breathing machine. When was it otherwise? With every year, as he changed before their eyes from a god to a man, to a walking fossil, it grew progressively wider, whereas, from his perspective, it was they who withdrew while he remained where and whatever it was he had always been. The breathing machine can only breathe. Someone, too, was once a machine for breathing. Ingenious, the inspiration, the expiration. Together now, the two of them can only breathe. The little breaths follow one another like lemmings tumbling over the edge into emptiness. Not one reaches out with its tiny paws to scrabble the silence. No small talk, no faltering song. Someone else is walking round a corner, trundling his heart like a kilo of rib roast home from the market. or driving out of the city, nestled in the bosom of his Buick, thrumming to heavy metal. Someone bored, inching nearer, nearer to the edge with someone's heart in his hands. Someone uncomprehending, blissful, doomed, who doesn't need to see someone hovering, heartlessly waiting ahead. He got his heart. If you wait long enough, you can have a heart. Something a little lighter from my earlier years. This is a poem called Lilith. You know who Lilith was? She came along before Eve, actually, according to, I think it was Hebrew myth. At least that's what somebody explained to me later. I didn't know. I just knew that somebody had the notion in mind that there was somebody before Eve. She was apparently a much hornier type than Eve, though we blame her for everything, which is not quite fair. Blame Lilith, and I think that would be a lot fairer. This is a poem about her, or about a friend of mine that I haven't seen for a long time and sort of miss. I don't know, because I never saw Lilith, and I did see my friend. I keep looking her up, and I tried the Manhattan phone book, I tried the Brooklyn phone book, I tried the Bronx phone book. She doesn't seem to be in any one of them. Maybe she's gone back with the other myths. She hissed in my ear, "What can you lose?" She wasn't bad, but for that nose, that battle axe, long, loose black hair, black arrogant eyes, generous mouth, great creamy boobs on the frame of a boy. She laid for dwarves and garbage men, fucked like a snake, beak like a hawk, held open house in her round bed, without a foot, without a head. Where is she now? Slithering across what littered moonscape, stirring with that irreverent snoot the dreams of virgins, dry, gritty snatches of spinsters, night lizard, demon of lonely sleepers, while we rumble and turn in our four-squared bed, between us a field, a flock, a house, two grumbling boys, 20 years of sweat and bread and everything to lose. That was actually Cain speaking. It was Adam speaking, kind of yearning for Lilith to come back from wherever the hell she was. And hell, I guess, is where she was, as far as I can figure out. I got a couple more, and then I can run away, or you can run away. One of them is called One More Secret, and it's gone. I know it's in there somewhere. It is a poem about a rather marvelous little, yeah, here it is, a marvelous little quote. Again, these quotes really turn me on. This one came from a book called Secrets of Companion Planting. Hemp, in case you don't know, parenthesis, cannabis, grown in the neighborhood of potatoes, helps protect against Phytophthora infestans, the cause of late blight. I thought about that for a long time. I just imagined those potatoes down there and the hemp up above. Behind the house, a seance of stoned potatoes meditates on the boundlessness of loam. lost in contemplation, those subterranean Platos are turning inward their myriad stone-blind eyes, from which one day uncertain shoots may sprout. It is unlawful now, at least where I live, she said. All I can see from up here is their deep green hair quivering in the steamy August breeze. But there are nights I can almost make it out, that symposium of wise, old, blight-free sages buried in speculation and ready to eat. One more, and then, as I've written down here, welcome, sweet death. I wrote it down at the bottom of this. I just noticed this poem is called Piano Man, and it is from my childhood. It's about a dear friend. I'm sorry he's not here right now, Bobby Betts. One of my dearest friends. The poem is an echo of a time when Bob got a terrible, terrible case of frostbite. Because most of the time, if he wasn't only blind, he was also drunk. Here it is. Thanks, man, he mumbles at the cabbie, relinquishing his arm, flashing over his shoulders that incorrigible blind man's smile, a parting shot, then turns it on me and reaches out his hand, clenched around something I can't hope to see. The blunt, frost-blackened fingers graze my palm, stiff but oddly civil, a manicured claw. 2 years ago, coldest night of the year, coming home from a two-bit taproom gig, the smile froze to his face like a mask of ice. Snow lay around so thick he couldn't raise a peep from the pavement with his radar stick. A block to the left and 2.5 to the right. Then he curled in an alley and slept the sleep of the numb between nine jiggers of whiskey and the weather. Lighting up now, he clamps his cancer stick close to the tip to steady it for the flame. Incense of smoldering flesh. Can't work his zipper, asks me, can I wait while he fishes it out and dribbles over his shoes to zip him up? Hard luck pounded a rolling bass on his bones. But didn't he ramble through the difficult changes? And doesn't he parry my question with the same damned smile? Look, man, blindness is the least of my problems.